and thank you for listening to the History of World War II podcast, episode 369, interview with Paul Brandis, as he talks about FDR's use of the radio and newspapers. Paul Brandis, the author of several books, including This Day in U.S. Military History and This Day in Presidential History, has come on the show to use his experience as a White House correspondent to discuss FDR's brilliant use of the media in his day, to inform, but also to ensure his fellow citizens that their country would endure this world war. Mr. Brandis, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's my pleasure, but please call me Paul.
I will try to override my Southern programming, and I'll do the best I can, but no promises. Okay. So, first of all, I want you to know, thank you for coming on to the show, but I wanted you to know that I was enjoying some of your books very much. The first one, This Day in U.S. Military History, I'm enjoying that one, but also another one, I didn't think about this at first, but when I saw that you had this book, Under This Roof, The White House and the Presidency, 21 Presidents, 21 Rooms, 21 Inside Stories. I got to relive my love of the West Wing show all over again just by getting inside that building and exploring its history. So I was hoping, before we jumped into World War II, if you could give us maybe an example of one of your stories from that book.
Well, it's as the sort of the subtitle says, it's 21 rooms, 21 stories, 21 presidents. And I did it that way just because, you know, we all know the White House and the presidents and the first families who have lived there. But I wanted to kind of take the storytelling in a bit of a different direction and tell some of the stories that have that went on in each particular room. So I would pick one room or one part of the mansion that I think we're all familiar with, the Oval Office, for example, or the Situation Room. And I would, a lot of stories for each of those rooms, but I would try and find one that was interesting and write about it.
Cool. Yeah, no, I was watching you on YouTube getting ready. And yeah, some of those stories, especially with Jefferson and Adams, that was really neat to go blast in the past and to see how that building came about over the years.
Right, right. Well, it was interesting because the White House, a lot of folks don't know, but the White House is one of the oldest buildings in the United States. It was finished in 18, well, it wasn't finished, but it was ready for a habitation in 1800. And George Washington, who picked the site, was the only president who actually never lived there. John Adams was the first to move in, and he was only there for a couple of months because he lost the election that year to Thomas Jefferson. So it was really Jefferson who began to make some of the early changes to it. And over the preceding, over the succeeding 222 years or so, the building has continued to evolve. Every president has put his particular touch on it in one way or another. So it's a work in progress.
Right. I'm glad you brought up Jefferson because many, many years ago, I worked at Monticello and we had driven into us that that man liked to tinker. He liked to change things. He liked to improve things. He would look at a building or a room or whatever, and he would see potential for better. And he just couldn't help himself. He was going around tinkering with things all the time.
Well, Jefferson was sort of a jack of all trades. I mean, he was an architect and a farmer and a surveyor and an inventor and a botanist and on and on and on. He made wine, and he actually, the design for the White House was an open competition, and Jefferson submitted an anonymous entry himself. It wasn't picked, but it very well could have been, and then the White House would have looked quite differently than it actually does.
Oh, okay. So he could have got his personal stamp on the White House as well. That reminds me, you probably know this better than I do. Obviously, many, many years later, Kennedy is dining in the White House and he's got a small party with him. And he says something like, never has so much talent been in this room or at this table, except for when Thomas Jefferson dined alone. Because that's how smart he was. You know, it just like you said, he was a polymath maybe, but just a very well-read person with a wide diversity of interests.
The Kennedy party, by the way, the dinner party was a dinner party for all living Nobel laureates in the United States and obviously some other people on that level. But what a wonderful comment that he made, and certainly reflective of his view of Jefferson.
Exactly. And I'm glad you remember that, because that makes it even more touching. So before we jump into this, could you tell us a little bit about yourself? And I would really like to hear about some of your time, because you were in Moscow for a couple of years. If you could share any experiences you have, that would be great.
Well, I spent 5 years in Moscow. I have a degree in Russian history, and I went off, this is a long time ago, to work right. in the American Embassy in Moscow. And then I decided that it would be actually more interesting and more exciting to leave the government. And I became a journalist, so I became a foreign correspondent based in Moscow. And I spent several years after that just traveling all over what then became the former Soviet Union, literally every nook and cranny of that country, 11 time zones, just visiting everywhere. And just, it was just an amazing time to be there, and kind of very sad about what has happened to it in the last couple of months. That's a whole nother discussion. But for me, at least, it was just what an incredibly colorful, exciting time for me to be there.
Yes, and hopefully a better period of relations between our two countries is in our future. So I absolutely agree with you on that. So let's go ahead and just jump into this. So I wanted to have you on the show because out of everything that I've done, and I'm up to like early 1942, I haven't really gone into detail about FDR using the radio, the fireside chats, anything he might have had worked out with newspaper guys. You know how politics works. And I was hoping you could maybe bring some of your experience of being a White House correspondent, and I'm sure this is a subject that you've looked into, but could you speak to Roosevelt's, I don't think there's any other word for it, deft touch when it comes to using the tools, the newspapers and the radios, and the way he did. Was he groundbreaking, or was he just really good at it?
Well, first of all, let me say that even among our more recent presidents, we talked about John F. Kennedy a couple of minutes ago, Kennedy and even Ronald Reagan, both of those presidents who are well known for their communication abilities, their speaking abilities, their deft touch with the media and all that. Each of them, Kennedy and Reagan, each gave FDR all the credit for what they became, which is an incredible compliment to Franklin Roosevelt and his ability as a master communicator. And think about it. Ronald Reagan and John F. Kennedy both said, well, if it weren't for Franklin Roosevelt, I might not be here today. So what was it about Franklin Roosevelt that really made him so amazing? It was really just a couple of things. And first, I'll preface all that by saying that the radio was not all that new when Roosevelt became president. I mean, Warren Harding, a dozen years earlier, was the first president to actually speak on the radio. And then there was Calvin Coolidge and Herbert Hoover after that. So there had been three presidents prior to Roosevelt who were on the radio. The problem is that none of them were very good. They didn't have a good voice. They weren't. Right. They didn't speak in the right style. They didn't just, whatever the reason was. Roosevelt, meantime, before he became president, he was first elected in 1932. He had been a governor of New York before that. So he'd spent, which is very obviously a prominent job in and of itself, and he had spent a couple of years listening to these other presidents on the radio, and he just thought that he could do better. So by the time he came to the White House in 1933, when he was inaugurated, he was ready. And he understood, unlike these prior presidents that I mentioned, he understood that radio is a very intimate medium. It's really you, like you and me, for example. It's just basically you know, one guy talking to another. And Roosevelt knew that obviously tens of millions of Americans were listening, but he always thought of himself speaking with just one other person. It was that simple, that informal, that intimate. And it was that from that standpoint that allowed him to be so conversational, so at ease. And when Americans heard Roosevelt on the radio, he would get tons of letters at the White House, and they would say things like, you just make it seem like you're a member of our family. Wow. We're sitting in our living room listening to you, things like that. It was really powerful. And of course, the fact that there were no other, really no other, there wasn't television, for example, there certainly wasn't social media. It was really at the time, it was radio and it was the newsreels before the movies and newspapers. So there really was this huge diversity of platforms that presidents have to struggle with today. There are only a handful of platforms, and Roosevelt made the most of it. But the main thing was that he was just simple and informal. And the other key thing, too, this is where John F. Kennedy comes in. Roosevelt also had a philosophy that less is more. People always know him for his famous fireside chats, but in the 12 years that he was president, people are always surprised to know this, he only gave about 30 fireside chats in his 12 years. In other words, two or three times a year, he would do these. So the very infrequency of them added more drama when he did appear, which was quite amazing. And when John F. Kennedy became president, one of the first things he asked one of his aides, how many of those fireside chats did Roosevelt give? And when Kennedy was told that was only about 30, Kennedy had kind of validated what Kennedy had been thinking. And Kennedy also decided that he, obviously the president can go on television whenever he wants. Mm-hmm. Kennedy obviously could have done that. Kennedy decided that he would make very infrequent appearances as well, which he did. And of course, when Kennedy did go on television, the few times that he did, sort of like Roosevelt, the infrequency added to the drama when he did go. And that's sort of a lesson I think that current presidents seem to have forgotten. Presidents these days are everywhere. They're on television every day, and they're on social media every day, and this and that. And I think we tend to get tired of our presidents after a few years, and sort of the phrase that familiarity breeds contempt. I think that applies in no small part to our politicians, who think they have to have an opinion on everything. They have to react instantly to everything. They have to have their flood the zone with appearances. And I think that's a mistake. And although Roosevelt, obviously the president 90 years ago, it was a very different time. But nevertheless, I think the philosophy is interesting. I think sort of the less is more is a very powerful thing. It adds more to the drama and the mystique of what being a president is, rather than just, you know, being ubiquitous and available all the time, which tends to kind of, dilute the power of the office.
I couldn't agree more. And I'm glad you brought up the intimacy, because like you said, you and I are talking, but your voice is in my head. You know, it's like there's this immediate connection, because I feel like, this bond almost. So between something like that, between FDR's gift of gab, between his ability to speak plain and to feel like he's talking to everybody and not just making this broad speech to hundreds of thousands of people, I guess that was a connection, and people really needed that, because as we know, the 1930s were anything but calm, and they probably appreciated very much when he would come on and say, you know, this is what we're going through. We're going to do the best we can. Everything will be all right. You just have to trust me.
The other thing about that is that Roosevelt, like Kennedy, these are obviously very well-educated men that both went to Harvard and so forth. And yet when they spoke, they used small words. They spoke slowly, sort of like I'm doing now. They used small words, spoke short, simple sentences, did not talk down to people. And it was just enormously effective because it reached, it helped them reach, might say the lowest common denominator, but it helped them reach far more people than had they, you know, used their Harvard vocabulary and things like that. I've seen these studies that have taken recordings of, you know, Biden now or Trump or Clinton or Obama or any of our recent presidents, and they say that well, these presidents tend to speak at a kind of a higher education level than most Americans have. And I wonder if that might be a mistake as well. You know, so I think, again, I think the Kennedy and FDR thing was short, simple sentences, speak slowly and calmly. It's very powerful and effective. And I'm not sure that a lot of presidents, a lot of politicians in general these days, are not really getting the right advice in terms of how to speak with people. Just my opinion.
Right. No, I certainly do love the folksy touch. And yeah, I think that's been lost. Everybody wants everyone else to know how smart they are or how big their vocabulary is. And so they just throw out these words. But you're right. It is about effective communications. And if you're not doing that right, then your whole message is going to be off.
Well, that's right. If you can't communicate effectively with the public, then what good is it?
Exactly. You're wasting your time. So I know you can't be with us long, but I wanted, the other reason I wanted to bring you on is because I know you've dove into the story of Midway. And as it turns out that when I recently stopped covering the Pacific Theater, I went from Pearl Harbor almost right up to the Battle of the Coral Sea and Midway. So I'm glad that you're here. I was hoping we could talk about Midway a bit. And so let's just jump into this. So why does the Battle of Midway take place in the first place? What's so specific about this?
Well, Midway was really just, I think, the pivotal battle in the Pacific in World War II. Naval historians think that, Winston Churchill thought that, and some historians, in fact, have called the Battle of Midway one of the most consequential naval engagements in world history, which is not hyperbole. It was just hugely and strategically important in World War II. And it really only happened about, Pearl Harbor was December 41. Well, this was June 42. So it was really only about, a couple of months after Pearl Harbor, and it turned the entire Pacific War around. After Midway, when the United States sank four Japanese aircraft carriers in just a couple of hours, really, it really broke the back of the Japanese and their ability to extend their offensive in the Pacific. After Pearl Harbor, there were fears that not only would Hawaii be attacked again, but the west coast of the United States would be attacked. It was a very real fear. Midway changed all that. And Midway occurred for a couple of reasons. I think the Japanese made a huge mistake at Pearl Harbor. They missed the American aircraft carriers at Pearl. They got the battleships, obviously, most of them. The aircraft carriers, for various reasons, were not there. They missed them. So the Japanese knew that if the American aircraft carriers were still available and operational, well, then they had to take out the carriers. And it was the Japanese goal. One goal of Midway was for them to do that. And Midway was also used as a submarine base for the United States. It's about 1,200 miles northwest of Pearl Harbor, I think 1,100, 1,200 miles, I think. So by putting a naval base, a submarine base there, it would sort of extend the range of the U.S. Sub fleet. So it was just strategically important in a lot of ways. So the Japanese wanted to take Midway out. And what happened was I think one of the key things about Midway is that American cryptographers broke the Japanese code and determined that Midway was one of their key targets. And one way they confirmed that Midway was on the Japanese radar, if you will, was that they planted a phony message. Today we would call it disinformation. They planted a message to the effect that the water purification system on Midway was on the fritz. So they're running out of fresh water. It was not true, but they planted that. They broadcast that in an unencoded message just to see if the Japanese would take the bait. Well, they did, and that was how the Americans confirmed that Midway was going to be a target, and they planned accordingly. And then when the Japanese steamed toward Midway, they had six carriers for the Pearl Harbor attack, but only four for Midway, and they were dispersed so far apart that really the U.S. was able to sort of pick them off, and that's how the battle was won. It was just a remarkable battle. And after that, the Japanese were never really able to, they were essentially on the defensive for the rest of the war after that, because their long-range offensive capability had been destroyed at Midway. So it was just a hugely influential battle.
Right. And of course, just like you mentioned, the great irony was Yamamoto wants to finish off Pearl Harbor. He wants to take out the American carriers. There's three at the time. One was damaged. And of course, just like you said, we end up taking out four of their carriers. So the irony is it lost there. But yeah, so for all of Yamamoto's bravery and the professionalism of his men, I mean, they did make mistakes. And you just mentioned a big one. We did crack their codes and we could see what they were talking about. And like you said, with the water treatment,
yep,
we were able to test that theory.
Right, right.
That's incredible. So, and you've already kind of touched on this already, but yeah. So, what I remember when I did Pearl Harbor was that Admiral Yamamoto tells the Japanese government, he goes, "Look, if we can hit Pearl Harbor and we can hit them hard, I can run wild for 6 to 12 months." Well, as you just said a couple of minutes ago, the Americans made sure that was 6 and not 12, with the incredible outcome of the Battle of Midway.
That's right. And the other thing, by the way, about that,
yeah,
sort of a preface to Midway was another hugely important event, too, and that was the famous Doolittle raid, which I think was in April 1942. Mm. And what happened there was that General Doolittle decided that, Roosevelt decided, first of all, that the American people needed sort of a morale booster. He said, "We got to hit the enemy. We got to figure out something we can do." And it turned out that this was what they decided upon. And what Doolittle did was they got as close to the Japanese coast as they could and launched, I think, 16, but not a lot. It was not a huge raid. I think about 16 bombers, B-25 Mitchell bombers. And they flew to Tokyo and other cities, and they dropped their bombs. And they didn't really hit any significant targets or anything. Right. From a strategic standpoint, it really wasn't much. But from a psychological standpoint, it was a huge blow to the Japanese. They'd been attacked on their homeland. It had never happened before. It was a huge embarrassment. And that was part, that kind of played into their decision to attack Midway as well. So Midway, I think, not Midway, but rather the Doolittle raid was just, that's a hugely important story as well.
Right. It almost sounds like Midway, in some ways, was almost an emotional response versus just a strategic or tactical. And, of course, that's what you want to do. You want to get your opponent emotional. That way they're not thinking and they make mistakes. And like you said, the Japanese lost four carriers that day. So yep. Big mistake.
Yep.
Well, Mr. Brandis, I want to thank you for your time and your insights today. I do want the listeners to know that besides the books we've mentioned, The White House and the Presidency, and This Day in U.S. Military History and Presidential History, you also have another book that I have added to my summer reading list. It's Jackie, Her Transformation from First Lady to Jackie O. I've always been fascinated by her and what happens to her after the assassination, so I'm really looking forward to that book.
Well, the Jackie book is interesting because there have obviously been a ton of books about the Kennedys, a ton of books about Jacqueline Kennedy, but they all tend to focus on her period in the White House or maybe later in life when she was a book editor in New York and all of that. That's all well and good, but I decided to look at kind of a more under-examined period of her life, and it was the five-year period between her two marriages. Her life in some way is sort of defined by these two very powerful men that she married. One was the president of the United States. The other was one of the world's richest tycoons. Two very incredible men that she married, but there's this five-year period in between when she was on her own, kind of a single mom. Well, not exactly her typical single mom, but nevertheless, right. On her own, living in New York with her two kids and all the drama and the colorful, sometimes frightening things that she had to go through, the men she dated, her search for new love, her financial struggles. She had tremendous financial struggles, too, that people don't really know about. So just a ton of interesting stories about her during that five-year period.
Right. She married into the Kennedy family, but she wasn't a Kennedy. So I imagine after her husband's gone, she doesn't have access to their family fortune.
Well, she was taken care of, but not but not all that much. Gotcha. She bought a home a couple of weeks after, 2 weeks after the assassination, she moved out of the White House. And a couple of weeks after that, she bought a home across the street on N Street in Georgetown. She needed to borrow money from the Kennedy family to buy that house. And Robert Kennedy helped with the financing of that and so forth. And the same thing when she fled Washington in 1964, moved to New York and bought a co-op apartment in a very nice building on Fifth Avenue. She had to borrow money to buy that as well. So she had... she was in no danger of starving, but the perception that she was rolling in dough was not correct. This home was important. She had private school for her kids because of security concerns, and Jackie and Caroline and John, they got all kinds of security threats and the occasional death threat and just, you know, that sort of thing. There were security guards. And there are nannies and maids and cooks and all of that. So, again, not exactly your typical single mother. But there were expenses associated with all of this that she couldn't necessarily handle. So during the 5 years that she was on her own, she was in no danger of starving, as I mentioned. But to suggest that she was raking it in, as people commonly think, really isn't true. And what drove her into the arms of Aristotle Onassis, who at the time was just maybe the second or third richest man in the world, this is 1968, was after Robert Kennedy was murdered in June of 68, she was deathly afraid, not just for herself, but her kids. She was deathly afraid of security for her and her kids. Aristotle Onassis offered her all the security in the world, plus all the money in the world. So that's why she married him.
I would have as well. But and again, I've always had a soft spot for Jackie O. But I mean, could one woman have to should one woman have to put up with so much in her life? I mean, you know, obviously incredible highs, but also incredible lows as well. So I'm really looking forward to that one.
Well, thank you. It's a good, I think it's just a really interesting story.
Cool. So again, Mr. Brandis, I know you're a busy man. I want to thank you for your time, but I'm enjoying the book This Day in Military History very well. There's always little nuggets that you forget, and it's nice to be reminded of that. So I want to thank you for that book and thank you for your time today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much. I'd love to come on again.
That would be great. You keep writing books and we'll keep talking.
Okay.
How's that sound?
Okay. Thank you so much.